Okay, thank you very much. Some of you know that my conversion experience took place because of a fellow by the name of Bill Threlkeld, the guy who spoke to us yesterday on communication. When Rock was talking the other night about leadership, kind of introducing this whole thing, and he brought the concept up that when you are converted, you tend to idolize this particular individual, and you tend to mimic his behavior and do the things that he does. And I thought, you know, I got to stand up and say, no, that's just not true. I don't do that at all. But I decided not to do that. It's funny that I should be here. Funny in the fact that it's fulfillment for me in a lot of ways. When I was at SAC headquarters, I had many years ago tried to get to the academy to teach. I was turned down because I didn't have a master's degree. That was then taken care of. While I was at SAC headquarters, the Air Force Academy asked me if I'd be interested in coming out there to teach. And, of course, I left at the chance. I was overage. That is, they want younger people, and they want guys who are lesser ranked because it costs less money when they go to tell Congress how much it costs to do school a student out there. But during the time as I was praying about whether I should come here, God laid on my heart that one of the things that He would have me do when I come here is get involved in leadership training for the navigators. That hadn't even started in its embryonic stage. Doug Spartz hadn't even come up with the idea. I hadn't shared that with anybody. So I said, yes, I'll try to come. I put in my application. The Military Personnel Center turned me down flat, said, no, we can't let you go. You've got to go back into personnel work and stay there. They turned me down flat 3 times. And the Air Force Academy fought me for me 3 times as I was getting older and higher in rank and costing more. And finally, God opened the door and got me to come here to the Air Force Academy. And I was supposed to teach the basic course in psychology. By the time I had gotten here, they had changed, and I was now teaching the leadership course. And nobody told me anything about it or told me why they had done it. They just said, we want you to teach the leadership course. Soon after that, they said, we want you to be the course director for it. And so that's what I've been doing in preparation for what God has brought us together today for. So I can just let you know that God's been working on this project for a long time. And I'm just really pleased to be a part of it. Some of my students at school accuse me of having what they call air-cooled pen lectures. That's because it moves along so quickly, and it will move along pretty fast today. I've got a number of things I want to share with you. The things that are going to be shared I think will be extremely useful to you. One, you'll be able to know what the difference is between leadership and management. Another thing you're going to be able to do is to know what a definition for leadership is, a secular definition, not the one that Doug is using. Okay? It's a little bit different because it has a much broader perspective. It takes in just about anybody who would be in a leadership position. You'll also know something about what the difference is between being just the head of an organization or a group and being its leader, and how a person gets to move from that position of headship over here over to leadership over here. Those are things that we'll try to deal with in this particular hour. I also would like to deal with the concept of how you make group decisions good group decisions as opposed to real bad group decisions. Something we'll deal with not here, but later on out at Eagle Lake, we'll be dealing with the concept of followership and what is constituted in followership. And it's really neat. I helped to write the article on followership, and they allowed me to extract large amounts from a fellow by the name of Ray Hu and his little, call to serve package into Air Force publications, which is just exciting. As a matter of fact, it's very free out there. You can share the scriptures in the classroom under academic freedom, and you're not put down for it. In fact, they're very responsive. But let's go ahead and get on into now leadership primarily. A little background. Long time ago, the only way leadership ever changed was from hand to hand through kings. You had to have to be in the royal bloodline, or you had to have a coup or something like that to establish the royal bloodline in order to be able to become a leader in a country. But royal blood became thin. There got to be less and less of it, and a lot of other problems with inbreeding and all kinds of issues. And as a result, they had to do something else, and began to pick on people based on traits. The very first leadership theory, then, was the one that concerned traits. It's called the trait theory. And just said superior endowments were the things that really constituted what a leader would be and how you chose a leader. The problem that came up with that and why it was discontinued and still remains discontinued in most forms is that they came up with over 4,000 traits. Now, it's hard to pick a guy and say, man, he's got all 4,000 of them. So they reduced it down to 50 core traits. But nobody could agree on how you really saw those traits, what they really looked like, and how you could tell a guy really had them or if he was just faking it. So they said, hey, you know, trait theory just isn't going to work too well. There probably are some traits that people ought to have, but we can't decide on who ought to be a leader and who ought not to be a leader by doing that. About that time also, we decided to get into some real serious research on leadership. And by the way, we're the only country in the world that has ever done or that is now doing leadership research that we know of, academically speaking, doing real research. In fact, we've got about three universities in our country who do a lot of research work. Ohio State, there's ISU out in the West Coast, and a few other places that do leadership research. They came up with what they call the environmental, was the next one. That is, a leader is conditioned by his environment. It's his environment that'll pull a guy out. So if he happens to be a guy who knows how to rough it in the woods and you guys are out in the woods someplace, well, he'll naturally emerge because he's the expert. If it happens to be in an office, well, the guy who can naturally handle administration will naturally emerge. That didn't work too well because some guys just didn't talk. I mean, they had the skills, but they didn't talk. The next thing, as you can see, is personal environmental. And that's what they said, let's match the thing between people and their traits and the environment. And again, they ran into the trait problems as well as the trying to have people just naturally emerge with that. And they went on to what they call the social exchange theory. I'm going through these very quickly because this is just going to give you some background. Social exchange, that is how people work in groups. What happens within a group to create a leader out of the group. It isn't so much that the leader emerges, it's that the group creates the leader in the social exchange theory. The next one was purely humanistic. You know, there are just some people who can really do it, and it's all focused on people. It's all focused on their needs. And the guy who's able to achieve and deal with those needs the best is the guy who's going to be the leader. Expectational. This one dealt with, and it still has a great deal of credence. In fact, there's lots of things you can learn from it. And Myron Rush will be talking a little bit about this concept of expectations. What you expect from a person is what you get from them. What you expect a person to be is what you'll actually be able to get them. And I don't want to go any further than that because I don't want to say some things that Myron might contradict later. No, he won't contradict him. But the one that we'll be dealing first with today is called the contingency model of leadership. And it's probably the most researched model that's been worked on. The one we'll deal with tomorrow is going to be on the situational model. And I'm going to have a friend come in and talk about that, Captain Fred Harburg, who's very good in this area as well. Path goal theory is kind of out in a field of its own, and it just means that if you have a goal, whoever it is who's able to tell you how to get to that goal, he's going to be the leader in that particular project and that project alone. Okay? Just a little bit of quick background. Now I'd like to share with you some ideas on what the differences are between leadership and management. One of the first things that's a real difference is that leadership, it tends to be a quality of a person. Something, by the way, you can develop. It's not an inbred quality. It's not something you're born with, an inherited one. Although some people are, by the way, born with characteristics which helps them to assume more leadership roles and get reinforcement in that area. I remember one of the first things I was told when I got in the service was, if you want to be a leader, first of all, you have to be tall. So I figured, well, that lets me out. Of course, Napoleon's a noted exception to that, and a few other people are. The second thing he told me says, if you want to be a leader, you have to be seen by your reporting official shining your shoes, at least sometime during the week. And the third thing is, if you have a brand new idea, stifle it. Okay, well, those are just kind of kidding around, but and I wouldn't take those too seriously. Management, they say, is an art and a science. You can develop and learn a great number of skills to be a good manager. And not every leader is a good manager, and not every good manager can be considered to be a leader. Okay, and we'll see as we go down further why. Leadership must provide a vision. He's got to be able to look out in the future in a fairly long-range sort of planning idea, and he doesn't have to get into the nitty-gritty of planning, but say, this is where I think we ought to be 5 or 10 years from now. The pastor of the church that I happen to attend right now, Pastor Michael Tucker, is probably one of the clearest examples I know of what I would consider to be a real leader that I've ever seen and ever gotten personally to know. That man has got more things in his head right now about what he plans for that church 5 and 10 years from now than most people even in the church know. He's probably not exposed. In fact, I know in talking with him last night that he has not exposed a number of the things that he has seen for the church way down the road. When he took over the church, a very small group of people had just been divided, didn't look like it was going to go anywhere except collapse. And now he has built that church into something that is quite a place to see, primarily because he had vision. And he also happens to have a lot of management skills and is able to bring it off as well with the people that are around him. The manager will supply realistic perspectives and say, yeah, that's a nice thing to do. But after all, we don't have the resources or we don't have the people or we don't have the money to be able to do that. And we've got to think about now, how do we get the money? And the leader says, oh, yeah, I didn't think about that. Thinking now in terms of leadership being a pure form and management being a pure form. Hopefully there's a marriage there. Leadership deals with concepts while the management relates to functions. Who's going to do what? How is he going to get it done? Are we going to be able to make them mesh so that when one group over here is done with their project, that they're right done at the right time for this group over here to pick up and work on the second half of that project that they can't work on until the first group gets done? But the leadership is just saying, we need this and we need that and we need to be thinking about what we're going to do next week, next month, next year, and the next decade. Dealing with concepts, and that's a part of vision. Because of his providing vision, because he deals in concepts, he's got to have faith. If he doesn't have faith, he's not going to be able to accomplish very much at all. Because he can see things 10 years down the road, but if he doesn't believe that he's going to be able to get anywhere, he's not even going to propose them. And he won't share them with anybody. And as a result, they won't get anywhere 10 years down the road. Now the manager, the pure manager, is going to say, look, let's take a look at what we've got right now. Let's take a look at what we need. We've already obligated ourselves to do right now. Let's see if we can even accomplish that first before we think about 10 years down the road. Seeks for effectiveness. And there's a real difference. And I really appreciated that Lauren was, as he was praying and as he was talking this morning, and see, I think he really stressed this whole concept of there being not that we only want to be efficient, but that we want to be very effective. And there's a real difference. And let me give you an example for that, because I think this is an extremely important point. In the Air Force, they changed the rating systems. They decided that they would be able to categorize people in certain blocks, 1 through 10 blocks. The number one block being the highest amount, and they said there's going to be only a certain percentage of people are going to be able to exist in that block. A certain percentage of people in block number 2, and a certain percentage of people in block number 3. Very highly efficient management tool to be able to select who ought to get promoted. But it did something else. It destroyed morale. It took people who would normally be superior and were superior people who got 2s and 3s, they got out of the Air Force. They had no intentions of doing that before. But they said, hey, look, if that's the way they're going to deal with me, then I don't want to deal with them at all. And they booked. 3 years later, the general who implemented it said, I blew it. In fact, I heard him say that personally, not more than 3 feet away from me. And he said, I developed a very efficient management tool that was very ineffective for being able to get the work of the Air Force done. And they have dropped the system just like that. Which was very super to see that they would come down and be big enough to be able to admit that they had made an error and then change. It's an influence for good among potential resources. And here we're talking about people, especially people, as a potential resource where you can be an influence for good. But a leader can also use material items to be an influence for good. Clothing, you know, and food and various, you know, shelter, various things like that can be an influence for good. Whereas a manager will really try harder to coordinate the available resources to be able to have the best job done in the least amount of time. You know, with the least amount of efforts and accidents, etc. Because it goes back to the striving for efficiency. Nothing wrong with efficiency. Nothing wrong with it at all. We want to be efficient people. And I just hope we never have to make a real choice, but sometimes we may have to decide, when am I going to be more effective or am I going to be more efficient? I have seen people in staff meetings and I shared this with my own group last night, who have stopped a staff meeting when they had a particular thing they were trying to strive for. They've stopped it dead still and said, hey, look, we're not getting along. We've got interpersonal barriers. We've got to deal with those right now. Not a very efficient thing to do in terms of getting a particular goal done, but very effective, because once you've got those barriers out of the way, the goal was achieved much more quickly and a much more high-quality achievement was accomplished. The leader will provide direction, and the manager is concerned about control. Suspenses. Dates. PERT charting, if you know what I'm talking about there, where you chart starting here and I'm ending here, and you've got various functions that have to do various things at different times, and they have to get done at different dates, and so that they can link in with somebody else who's got another job to do. Again, it gets back to efficiency. He wants to be sure that everything is controlled properly, and there is a place for control. This guy's going to provide direction. He's going to be more a delegator than he is a guy who's going to be the manager who says, you've got to do this and this and this and this. Thrives on finding opportunity. That's what the leader does. And succeeds on accomplishment is what really stimulates a good manager. He finds himself accomplishing something, he wants to accomplish more. The leader oftentimes will take something that would look like a problem or an issue that would rather not deal with, and will say, man, that's an opportunity. You know, it's a different mental set. Let me give you a definition for leadership now, one that we use out at the academy. Being able to create the impression of consistently making successful decisions. The key word, I think, up there is impression. Being able to create the impression. Because not, and I'm not saying this in terms of being able to put on a facade. I'm saying this, you've got to have the people who work for you accept you as the leader if you're going to be the leader. That means it's their perceptions that you must be concerned about and not your own. Being able to create the impression of consistently making successful decisions. That doesn't mean 100%. That means consistent. Relative to group needs and goals and or desires, which are then willingly, another key word, the people want to do it. They are willingly carried to successful conclusions, either by those affected or by those whose actions will affect others. We're talking here, and I'm just showing a tier relationship or a functional relationship among people. Chain of command, so to speak. Being able to create the impression of consistently making successful decisions relative to group goals, needs, and or desires, which are then willingly carried to successful conclusions, either by those affected or by those whose actions will affect others. Depending on how high up on the chain of command you are. Now that takes, it's a very broad definition. It takes in good guy leaders and it takes in bad guy leaders. It takes in your successful secular leaders and it takes in your successful Christian leaders as well. Because Rock can't be a leader of this group. Lorne cannot be the leader of the organization called the Navigators unless you and all the people on the staff accept him as the leader. Now he can still be the head of the organization. And he can still run the organization as his administrative head. But I would say that that is not leadership. That is headship. And not leadership. You can be head of your ministry and not be its leader. And if you're not its leader, of course, it's just that much more difficult. You then have to become a very efficient manager. And you have to pick out the guy who appears to be the real leader in your organization, in your ministry. Okay, I'm going to take this off now if it's copied by the majority of you. Let's talk about this little concept called headship. Headship is concerned with relations between positions. Ministry leader, second in command, third in command, team leaders, you know, sub-team leaders. In military organization, you have the commander, the vice commander, you have your division chiefs, chief of staff, those sorts of things. We're talking about the relationship of positions. It is determined by rank, and it doesn't have to be the rank you wear on your shoulder. It is determined by position and status that you happen to achieve. Usually the board of directors or the president or the owner of a company has a fairly high position, normally. And expectations of subordinates. You see, in a headship position, you usually don't have a great deal of conflict. Because, you see, unless you overstep certain boundaries, when you walk into a particular position, people already expect that you're going to act and react in certain ways, that you're going to ask them to do certain things, because they say, you know, that's what everybody else has been able to do in that position. That's what is called for that position. You'll have a job description, and you'll be able to maintain your behavioral patterns in relationship to that job description. And so there'll be expectations of your subordinates. I walk into a classroom, I happen to have a certain position in that classroom. They expect me to teach. Those are the expectations of the subordinates, the cadets in the classroom. I have a position. I'm an instructor. And of course, I have the rank. I happen to be a major at this point, anyway. Subordinates usually do not try to resist. Again, unless you start doing things that are outside the boundary of what is normally expected for your position. Were I to come in the classroom and tell my students, look, you ought not go down to X movie house and see the movies down there. Those are bad news. I would have been overstepping my boundaries in terms of being headship, because I'm there to teach leadership. I'm not there to control their moral life, not in the classroom. Now, there may be times when we get into discussions, I'll be able to share some of my own personal conceptions of where they ought to go and where they ought not to go. But that's a little different situation. It's not used arbitrarily. And we're going to get into a concept in just a few moments where you'll see the concept called power is used arbitrarily. But headship or having a position of authority is not usually used arbitrarily. You have certain rules and guidelines you go by. The range of influence that you have over your people deals primarily with the technical aspects of the job. It doesn't usually have to do with things outside of the job that you're doing. Now, you have a little broader range as a ministry. If you happen to be the head of a ministry, you'll have a little broader range of things, except your technical area is going to be within the confines of the ministry and personal lives. And it will not be incumbent upon you to go to a guy who works for IBM and says, I think you're doing the job wrong. And I think really what you ought to do is change what the kind of work that you're doing within IBM. Unless it has to do with how he's relating to his boss. That may be an area you could get into, but you're not going to talk to him about his technical aspects of his job. It would be out of your range. Two-way communication is fairly necessary, although you may get along for some time with only one-way communication. Now, in our particular ministry with the Navigators, two-way is absolutely vital. And that's why we're talking about leadership, because leadership requires a kind of two-way communication where the people below you have an equal say with what you've got to say. And unfortunately, most of us tend to run our positions by headship and power than we do by leadership. I'll be showing that dichotomy in just a little bit. It is assumed by appointment. Somebody says, here's the job I want you to do, go do it. Bob, you're now a teacher. I want you to teach leadership. Assumed by appointment. It's not something that comes from the group or somebody else that helps you learn to do. Some of the differences now between headship and leadership is exercised by an appointed head for headship. Leadership is an evolved situation. It comes because of the perceptions of the people. Now, you may start off as the head of your ministry or as the head of your group of people and eventually become its leader, but you probably won't be the leader to begin with. Not as we're using the term of somebody who is accepted by their peers and subordinates as being the guy we want to follow, the guy we will take direction from. Means of assuming the role, as I already pointed out before, for headship it's appointment, but for leadership it's group acceptance. If you don't have group acceptance, just accept the fact that you are not the leader. You will be the head of your group, but you will not be the leader of that group. Group acceptance is absolutely vital to be a true leader. The basis of influence for headship is legal. That is, the organization which appoints you to a particular thing says you have certain rights and privileges that go along with being the appointed leader. And you can run your ministry the way you see fit, not the way somebody else sees fit. In the Air Force, it's within the prerogatives of, you know, our rules and regulations that my boss can make me do certain things because the law says so. That doesn't make him my leader. What makes him my leader is if I accept him on a personal basis because I believe he's competent. And I believe that when he tells me something to do, I know it's the right thing that I ought to be doing. That doesn't mean I follow him blindly, because there's another key aspect to leadership which we'll be dealing with that shows that you do not follow a guy blindly. Influence is legitimated by institutionalized values. For headship, the navigators have certain kinds of values they expect people to adhere to. In the headship, you can exercise authority over people based on those values. What are some of those values you'd expect to be able to, legally see you can influence people with in the navigators? Yes? I know I do. I have it on purpose. It's cocked on purpose because I can't get it all on without it, see? This pole's in the way. Can you move the pole, please? What's an institutionalized value for the navigators? Very good. Faithfulness to the ministry as you grow up in the ministry. Another institutionalized value would be something else. What? What else would it be? The TMS. Got to memorize TMS. Man-to-man time. Got to get that time, right, Don?
Conferences.
That's right. Got to go to conferences. Certain institutionalized values. Okay. However, the leader is accepted by the group based on the recognition of his contributions to the group goals. And I've seen people, I've had Leroy tell me, as a matter of fact, when I was over in Korea, and he was saying, what are you memorizing now? And I said, well, I said, I'm memorizing the little book packet on lordship. And he says, quit doing that. And he says, pick out the verses that are meaningful to you. Memorize them, because that's what's going to make an impact on your life. Man, I thought that guy was really contributing still to the group goals of being able to continue the memorization of God's Word. But it wasn't just that I had to do it just to be doing it, just to be doing it. Okay? And I really recognize that as being some good advice. Haven't memorized since. No, that's not true. I just took the first half. Quit doing that. The relationship of supervisor to subordinates. Headship is normally one way, that is, you do what I tell you to do. There is two-way communication to a certain extent, but mainly from subordinates to superior, it's for clarification. Did you mean for me to do this? Did you want me to do it in this particular way? And analyze your own ministry and see if perhaps that's not happening where you are. Are you able to go out there and say, okay, Raj, I want you to do this. I want it done by so-and-so date, if you can, please. Recognizing, of course, you've got no real authority over them outside of what they want to give you, because you don't have the law on your side. And all they do is ever come back and say to you, how do you want me to do it? You might take that as an indication that perhaps you're not exercising leadership but headship, because personal influences is both ways with leadership. One of the key items for leadership is that the subordinates are able to say no. I don't think we ought to do it that way. And in fact, I don't even think we ought to do that. I think really if we do what you're suggesting that we do, we're going to fall flat in our face. The ministry is going to be... I can't use that word. Somebody else said it's not a good word to use yesterday. The ministry is going to go downhill. Okay? I think we ought to have a conference. Maybe we ought to have it right over Thanksgiving. And the group says, no, I don't think so. Because if we have a conference over Thanksgiving, nobody's going to be around. Or if I have to go to a conference and leave my family, and that's a family tradition, and that's something that my wife and I have expected to have, and we've been married 14 years, I've got to have the ability to tell the guy I'm working with, Jimmy Covey, that no, I can't go along with that. I don't think we ought to do that. And have Jimmy feel not threatened because I'm happening to say no. Okay? It's responsible to superiors in headship much more than you are to subordinates. in leadership, you're responsible to both. In our particular ministry, the ministry is people, and we are ministering to our superiors, and we are also ministering to our subordinates, or the people who are in the ministry and on the team. The extent of control, just to the limits of legal authority, that is as far as the navigators will let you go. In leadership, it's beyond the limits of legal authority. If you're able to exercise real leadership, you'll be able to get into areas of a person's life that you would not normally be able to get into, that they would take offense to your getting into, if all you were doing is being able to exercise authority or headship over people. Social gap is wide with headship. That is, you don't get involved in very many social kinds of activities outside of the job. Now, you know, rallies are part of the milieu in which navigators work. So you have some social contact just with rallies, but that's part of the job as well. How much time do you find your ministry leader, or as you as a ministry leader, how much social time are you spending with the people in your group outside of the rallies? Outside of the coffee breaks with your at conferences. Now, as far as the social gap, it's very narrow. There isn't very much of a social gap with leadership. It's a narrow social gap. That is, there's much more interaction between people, and much more social time being able to be spent. The last item is behavioral pattern. Headship tends to be authoritarian. I'm going to tell you what to do, and here's how to do it, and here's when you do it. Very militaristic, and in fact, I've seen that in many of NAV ministries that I've been a part of. Very militaristic. I know of one in which you were required to have 10 verses memorized a week. You would spend 25 hours of time in Bible study. You'd give half of your paycheck. I mean, that was an absolute requirement, and if you didn't do it, you weren't part of the NAV team. Leadership tends to be more democratic. Okay, and that would be necessary if you're going to have this personal influence, being able to go beyond the limits of legal authority. Now, how do you move from being able to be appointed to a head as the head of an organization, and then being able to move into the leadership position, being accepted as the leader? Well, there are several things that you need to be able to do. If you want to move from headship to leadership, you need to know your job, know the technical aspects of your job, know what you're doing and what's expected of you on the job. It'd be also very useful to understand why you're being told to do what you're doing, so that when some of your own team members asks you why, you can tell them that. Tell them what you know. To know yourself and to strive for improvement. As Romans says, you've got to have a sane estimate of yourself. Always looking towards improvement. Always having the more positive attitude about what you can do, what God wants you to do, how much you're going to be involved in what God wants you to do. Very key element, knowing your people and looking out for their welfare. Especially in this environment where we're dealing, where our whole mission is people. But see, this is the truism for anybody who wants to be a leader of any organization. Whether it's navigators, or whether it's the Air Force, or whether it's IBM, or whether it's McDonnell Douglas, or whatever. Look out for their welfare. And one corporation, by the way, that does that very, very well is Hewlett-Packard. Very well. And my next door neighbor, for instance, hurt his back really badly and had to go into the hospital. They wanted to be sure. They had a guy go right down with him to be sure that the hospital treated him properly. They put him into a semi-private room, and Hewlett-Packard says, nope, want him to have a private room. They were willing to pay for that. He decided he wanted a semi-private, so they left him there. They called him twice a day to be sure that he was doing all right, that the hospital staff was treating him okay, and he was making some improvement. They visited him quite a bit. Didn't have to do that. Most corporations of that size don't take that time, but they do. Keep your people well informed. And this is an area where people do tend to fall down quite a bit, because I happen to understand what's going on. I've got it all up here in my head. I know what's going to happen next. I tend to expect everybody else knows. And I forget the fact that many of my people down below me don't know at all. How many times have you gone to a meeting, and I've done this, I've seen this, or it's happened when people have gone to a meeting, and half the people aren't there because they never got the word, because nobody ever put it out at all. Set the example. I believe that that was talked about this morning, if I'm not mistaken, when Doug Sparks talked about how Nehemiah set the example. You've got to be the role model. Ensure the tasks are understood. That's not understood, it was a misprint. Understood, supervised, and accomplished. By supervising, I don't mean having the eagle eye and always looking over a guy's shoulder and saying, you almost done? You almost done? Because we can get into this thing on evaluation, as Doug talked about this morning, that can get to be a very heavy burden. And I think that I really appreciate his using that term, sustain. Because one of the things you want to sustain is motivation and drive in the people that work for you and with you. In fact, it would be a good mental set to adopt for yourself is that nobody really works for you. Everybody on your team works with you. And you work together on this thing. It's a lot different attitude. Train your group as a team. And we're trying to do that here, trying to show you some of the techniques and some of the ways that we can begin to develop people as teams. And I don't think the Navigator ministry or any other significant ministry can really sustain itself if they don't get to work as a team. Make sound and timely decisions, developing and exercising good judgment. That's a lot of words. It's a mouthful. And it's not always easy to make timely decisions, but Myron Rush is going to be able to share with us some of the management techniques that we can learn on how to make good, positive decisions and to do it well, and how to exercise good judgment. Most of us think we already have that, so we probably don't have to learn too much from that, right? Seek responsibility and develop a sense of responsibility among subordinates. That's one of the things that I have noticed among the navigators that I've been a part of, navigator groups, and right here, is that people are not unwilling to accept responsibility. When there is a job to be done, I've seen very little reluctance on the part of most people here, or any other time I've been around nav groups, to getting the job done, and to standing up and saying, yes, I'll be glad to do that. And outside of an organization that is committed like this, and I've worked with other Christian organizations as well, who have shown the same kinds of tendencies. Outside, it's the rule is don't volunteer for anything, right? If you do, you're really making a big mistake. And take responsibility for your own actions. Don't scapegoat. Don't blame somebody else because you did something and it blew up in your face. The other day, I was responsible for a project, and I had to get it in by a certain time. I was really rushed, and it was just getting some information from people in our department back. A couple of the guys wrote in some kind of humorous phrases. It was, you know, what kind of hobbies do you have? We're going to send this to a 3-star general who runs, he's a superintendent. And one of the guys said, one of my hobbies is collecting fingernails. And there were a couple of other comments like that. Well, because I was so rushed and didn't take the time, I picked them all up, not pulling out the bad ones, and sent them off to the general directly. Now, the general's got an aide who's a friend of mine. And he called me up and said, Bob, did you really mean to send these? And I said, well, no, I sure didn't. I said, why don't you just send them back to me and we'll get this thing straightened out. He said, okay. But they didn't come back. And they didn't come back. And my boss called me and said, Bob, who was head of this project? Oh, man. I said, I was, sir. And he looked down here and he showed me saving fingernails. He said, General Orth just brought these to me. That was our 1-star. The 3-star had brought them to him. And the 1-star had brought them to my boss. And he said, Bob, how in the world could you have allowed that to happen? And I just have to say, sir, I just absolutely blew it. It was my mistake. It was a ridiculous thing to do, and I simply asked for your forgiveness for that. And he was speechless. Man, he expected a fight and defensiveness reaction, which would have been my normal way. If it hadn't been for the Holy Spirit, my normal reaction would have been very defensive. You know, I just got too much work to do here. I'm just absolutely inundated and I can't handle it all because I got too much and we need to get some of this stuff off and start blaming the work instead of accepting it myself. As a result of that, I could tell he was really upset and mad because his face was red and he was ready to really spit some nails. As a result of that, he turned around and says, well, you know, I was an exec once too. He says, you know, I pulled some boners, so I guess we all do, huh? And that's all I've ever heard of it. Okay. Accepting responsibility for your actions really made a difference in my life. Now I want to go into another concept at this point that is a third part of this concept of headship and leadership. I want to deal with something I've also seen here in the Navigators, and something I've seen in all organizations, by the way, and not just the Navigators. It's a concept called power. And I am not using power in a positive way. Okay, this is not the power of positive thinking. Very specific kind of definition. The capacity to deprive another of needed satisfactions or benefits, or to inflict costs on him or her for non-compliance with an influence attempt. It's a very negative thing.
Where did that definition come from?
It came out of a textbook of which I'm an editor. And it's also been in other publications as well. I don't happen to have the name of the original article that we took that from. Now, there's lots of things that we can do here to show that we actually do use power. Can you think of some needed satisfactions and benefits that can be deprived of you personally and may have even been threatened to be deprived? How about the one that was given as an example yesterday by Bill? That if you go home to take your wife home for Christmas and you come back, you're not going to be a part of the ministry? That's a power influence attempt. That's not leadership. That's not headship or authority. That's power, folks. And that's a misuse of our positions. There may be a few times in life when a power influence attempt is going to be necessary. But I'd say it's probably not necessary in the Navigators. I mean, I can't think of anything right off the top of my head right now. I could see perhaps in a combat situation you may have to use a power influence attempt to get a guy to be point, you know, with a army platoon when you're walking out into where the enemy might be. Either do it or I'll shoot you, you know. Quick court-martial. Okay, that's an outlandish example, but anyway, because you'll probably get it in the back anyway later on if you try and do that. Okay. There's lots of things that we can do if the guy doesn't do what we want them to do to actually show power. If you're not memorizing two verses a week, well, we can treat you like dirt. Now, we may never let you, you know, force you out of the group, but you can know that you're not a part of the group very easily because we're not accepting you. Not only that, but I'm not going to give you any positional responsibilities. I'm not going to let you handle anything. And even if you volunteer, I probably won't let you do it anyway. So I can deprive people of needed satisfactions and benefits. And one of the neatest things we like is being a part of a group and be accepted as a group member. Communication is one way. It's the person in power telling you what to do. And you don't really have much say-so unless you want to retaliate. There are certain counterproductive results when you use power that you can expect to see. If you ever feel the need to use power, you can expect these to be a part of it. Count the cost. Reduction in communication. The person may just stand there and grit his teeth and then go do what you told him to do. Later on, when he sees that you're about to make a mistake and he's got the information to correct that, you may not hear it. And you may fall flat in your face while he's laughing at you. The content of communication will be distorted. That is, he's going to be so upset with having to do something that you're forcing him to do that he's not going to hear all the details. Because he's going to be having a defensive reaction. He's going to be wanting not to do it and trying to figure out how in the world can I do? How can I get out of doing what I've been told to do? The facts may not reach the decision makers. And so the guy operates in a vacuum. Try running a ministry that way. And you'll find it's really difficult. You're living in a vacuum. There'll be large power losses. Every time you use power to get something done, you are going to lose a certain amount of that power. So if you ever figure you've got to use it for one reason or another, you better use it very judiciously and in very small amounts over long periods of time, because you can expect to lose power as you use it. And you'll see why in here in just a few moments. Power is used arbitrarily. It is usually not just thought out. The guy just says, I want it done because I want it done. And I want it done the way I want it done at the time that I want it done. Power makes people do things. That's why we put the quotation marks around makes, because it is an actual forcing situation. And people feel like, if I really want to stay a part of this organization, I'd better do it. Or I better just go ahead and leave the organization. Of course, that's one thing that people will do. They'll just leave the organization. We've talked about the fact that it is the capacity to deprive based on sanctions. That means punishment of any form. Power is based on sanctions. It's not based on your personal competence. You may have a lot of it, but it's not based on that. It's not based on your position. It's based strictly on how much you can punish the person for not doing it. It requires ties of dependence. Let's face it, if the person you're trying to force to do something isn't dependent on you for something, he's not going to do it. He'll just leave. Now, in organizations where people are actually hired on, and they get them into a situation that, hey, they've got to have the money from that organization to be able to stay, they've got stronger ties of dependence. In an organization like the Navigators, very few people really get hired on. In the ministry, it's usually volunteer work. You know, and you don't have to worry about having the strong ties of dependence. And that's one of the reasons why you don't see a lot of powers, kinds of plays that come down from on high. Power is an aspect of a personal relationship. It isn't a quality that resides within a person. That means it is a dynamic between me and another person. It's an aspect of our relationship. I've got power over something. A parent, oftentimes, too often as a matter of fact, exercises power over their children rather than leadership. You do what I told you to do because I told you to do it. And if you don't, it's going to be a spanking. If you don't, you're not going to be able to ride your bicycle. Punishment can be a part of training. There's no question about that. There's a place for punishment. And we probably won't have time to get into punishment, because that's a very important aspect of leadership that we just probably won't have time for. But there are certain costs and certain factors you need to consider and certain ways to punish, which we don't normally do. Results in esteem comparison. The person who is forced to do something in a power influence attempt feels like he is less of a person. Why? Because the person over him can make him do it. And it's something he doesn't want to do. And something he knows that if he doesn't do, he's going to get into trouble and he'll have some sort of sanction put against him. And so he has an esteem comparison. He's better than me because he can tell me what to do and I can't go against him for that. Communication is typically one way because the person in power doesn't want to listen to what another person below him has to say. He is not concerned. There are both benefits and costs. Can you think of any benefits at all to using power? That's right. It's expedient. You will get the job done, and that is if the person does it. You know, if you really got the aspect of that personal relationship, it's expedient. Anything else? John. May meet the demands of an emergency. And people are extremely reluctant because it's a dangerous kind of a thing to get involved with. That's right. Absolutely. That's one of the reasons why people want to use power. Because it makes them feel dominant, makes them feel superior. I can get him to do something, see, so I must be better than that person. The cost, we've gone over a number of them, and the cost is very high. And I already talked about the concept of the fact that if you use it, you're going to lose it. Now, let's talk about why you lose it. That's the next particular topic in terms of power. There are power reduction techniques that people who are being influenced by somebody in power or authority over them will take, certain actions they'll take. One of them is called a balancing action. And one of the things they'll do that is they'll reduce the dependency. Somehow, some way, they'll reduce that dependency. If a guy is dependent on another man for his money to be able to keep his family going and pay his bills, he may go out and start moonlighting. And while he's moonlighting and building up a stock of money, he's beginning to get himself schooled, say, in another kind of profession, so that when he can eventually, when he gets skilled enough in that, he can quit his job and go someplace else where he doesn't have that ties of dependence. Find alternate need satisfiers. That is, if you've got a particular need which must be met by this particular organization, the Navigators, for instance, the need to belong, what you may have to do is find alternate kinds of things that will be satisfying. Not that you'll, what you'll do is you'll just put the need to belong in a secondary position. And for at least a time, you'll find an alternate need which will be able to be satisfied. And you put off the first one. An alternate need satisfier. Another thing is to obtain more control, and you can do this in a number of ways. One of them you can do it, one way you can do it by is by flattery. Now that's not the honest way to do it, but it's used quite often. They make a guy dependent on somebody who's actually subordinate. They make him dependent in the sense of being able to give him positive strokes, because see, nobody else is going to give this guy positive strokes. He's a power kind of a guy. That's how he operates. And so he probably doesn't get any kinds of good, positive strokes. So the guy who wants to obtain power over him starts complimenting him. Okay? Polishing the apple, so to speak. It may not be true what he's saying, but he's doing that so he can gain power over him. Because all he has to do then, see, is begin to withhold those positive strokes. And the power figure begins to back off on his power influence attempts because he wants them. He may not even know that he's being manipulated. A much better way is to become an expert in an area. In an area that you know that that man who's in power over you has an absolute need for. And you begin to get to the point where you are a noted expert. And he's not going to want to lose you. And as a result, he begins to reduce his power influence attempts on you personally. You can make the power more dependent on you as well. And part of that is by gaining expertise. Part of it is by satisfying some of his own needs. Okay. The second broad category is to seek approval on some other basis. One of the things that you might do there is to seek approval in an area that you can get to be good at that is not an area that you had been good at before. So, and you know this is an area, say, that's been a gap in the organization. And so you become well-versed in that particular area, and all of a sudden the guy is being able to give you compliments, he's being able to see that he has a need for you, and so you get approval on some other basis other than what he has hired you on to do or for which you have become a part of the team member in the ministry. Okay, this relates to how you reduce power. This is exactly what will happen. It's supposed if I'm using power over you. These are some of the things that you may not even be aware of, some of the things that you'll end up doing. But these are things that we've done in research, have been able to ferret out of the research that people do to be able to reduce the amount of power. Because it's not a pleasant experience.
Okay, you find yourself in a power position, so you're doing this?
No. I'm in a power position over you, for instance. You don't like the fact that I'm forcing you to do things that you don't want to do. But the way I can force you is, see, I've got punishment capability over you. And so you'll start doing some of those kinds of things. You'll try to balance out my power. How you do that? By reducing your dependency on me. You'll get a second job, for instance. You may start going to campus crusade meetings, instead of Navigator meetings. Got you figured out already, right, Dave? Okay. Thanks for bringing that question up. Appreciate that. Finally, you'll increase distance, and this will probably be one of the first things that will happen to you. What you'll find is the guy's not around to see you very much anymore. He doesn't come to your meetings. If you call him on the phone, he's not at home. If somebody answers, he's just not around. He's not available to you. And I've seen lots of people misuse what they consider to be their position in such a way that they have pushed people out of the ministry because they were unwilling to accept them in a lot of ways, and they started using, and the people just said, hey, I don't want to be a part of this. In fact, I had one cadet gave me an indication of this. One cadet came up, and a friend of mine was saying, yes, I'm in the Navigators. And he says, oh, I see, you're the guys who worship the wheel. And what he was saying, as we explored it a little bit later on with other people as well, is that, hey, you guys are trying to force things on me in such a way that I have no latitude, no freedom of movement. And as a result, you know, I don't want to be a part of your group. I just don't. And so they increase distance. On the job, what you'll have is oftentimes a guy who's willing to work long and hard hours all of a sudden works an 8-hour day, and that's all, if he works that often. And if he works in an office that's adjacent to you, he'll not be around while you're around. Okay? I want to show you two more. Well, let me show you one more. Yeah, I can do that. I can forget that one. But let's do this one. Leadership emergence. How do you facilitate leadership emergence? And some of these, and this has come out of a synthesis of all the leadership research, and these are some things that have happened that have come out of it. One thing that says, if you want to become a leader, one thing you have to be able to do and be willing to do is to talk a lot. Now, that doesn't just mean run off at the mouth. But that does mean willing that if you've got an idea that is conducive to what the group needs to get done and the goals that need to be accomplished, that you're willing to stand up and say so and share those kinds of things. Now, when you talk a lot, what you want to do is be able to talk about what the task is and some information relevant to the task. So you've got to possess task ability, that is, being able to do some of the things, and some task-relevant information. Be willing to share and have the right information to share, and then be willing to sell yourself out to doing some of the work that's part of what you're trying to get done. Third, spontaneity has also been an extremely important part to facilitate the emergence of your individual person as being the leader. Being willing to be spontaneous. Now, oftentimes you'll hear people that tend to sound like a textbook. Like they've got it all memorized and all they're doing is playing back a tape. What you want to do is be able to not talk in a monotone and not appear unexcited, but be willing to really get excited about what you're doing, showing that you're committed to it, that you really like what you're doing, and that you want to continue on. Four, tolerance for freedom of action. This goes along with what we talked about earlier when we said that you have to allow your subordinates to be able to say no to you. What you might have to do is you have, say you appoint a committee over here to plan a conference or to plan a rally. And the guy who's doing it a lot different than what you would do. In fact, you think he's going to blow the whole war effort. What you may have to do is allow him the ability to make that mistake. It may turn out that he doesn't make a mistake at all. It turns out to be one of the best rallies or best conferences you ever had. But he's doing it a lot differently than what you would do. Acceptance of group members. And you're not always going to appreciate every group member. There'll be some guys you're going to say, you know, he's not my key guy. And I don't think he's going to be anybody's key guy. But if we went down the list of people who have been identified as non-key guys, you'd find a lot of them have turned out to be key men over the years. And you can look into the sports field for that. Johnny Unitas, by the way, was identified as being a non-key guy for football. If you read his biography, you'd be surprised how he ever got to where he got. I won't go into that now because it's time for lunch. Exhibit leadership acts. And the tendency is, by the way, to show greater concern for group goals and direction rather than followers. That's the tendency, but that's not right. That's not the way it ought to be. You need to be able to show an almost equal amount of emphasis for group goals and tasks and for people. And it's going to fluctuate. Sometimes you'll have to show more emphasis on people. sometimes you're going to have to show more emphasis on the job and getting it done. Over the long haul, it ought to be about equal. Yes.
Are these things that I do if I want to improve in leadership?
That's correct. Things that you want to do to be able to show that you want to be the leader. If you want to be the leader, these are some of the things you want to be able to do. And that's a synopsis of all the leadership research that's been done up to, I think, 2 years ago is when the book was written. And these things dropped and fell out of all the research. Okay, can we have one more quick question? No, take two then. Why don't you go first?
Well, I wasn't with the question, but the talent for freedom of action, wouldn't that be when you describe the limits or standards?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're not going to want some guy to go down, you know, and do some things that are so far out that would destroy the ministry just on the concept of freedom of action. That's right. You still want it to be moral and ethical and this sort of thing. The means don't justify the ends. It would be probably group standards. That's right. Not necessarily your own. Mm-hmm. John, no? Okay. Shall we close with prayer? Prayer and then go?
Yeah, I would do that.
Okay. Heavenly Father, I just want to thank you so very much for the opportunity we've had here, the beginnings of this week, and for the time we spent here this morning. Lord, I just ask that with all the information that they've been inundated with in the last hour, that they're able to ferret out for themselves the one or the two items that they need to see themselves work on to be able to develop themselves into more of the kind of leader that you want them to be. We ask it in Christ's name. Amen.